bank and agent bank liability. We want to try and understand the role and function of the parties who are members of these larger facilities, whether it's a Euroloan deal or a Eurobond deal. What we're trying to do is understand all of the relevant rights and duties of each of the parties so that if anything goes wrong, we can determine possible areas of liability and then we can control and limit that liability. As a financial lawyer, this is your key duty to your client. You need to ensure your client understands all of their responsibilities, their duties, and that they are able to discharge all of those and avoid any unforeseen liability of any form. This becomes even more complex, for example, in larger project finance deals. There's so many other aspects of law involved in these cases that we have to very carefully identify all of the possible heads of liability, all of the possible areas of risk, and then allocate that risk. That's the purpose of the finance documentation, is to allocate risk. In the simpler transactions, like the loans and the bonds, we're transferring as much of this back onto the other side, onto the clients, onto the borrowers. They want to borrow, so they're borrowing at their risk. The banks will take on all responsible measures that they're responsible for, but any ancillary external risk, that has to be passed back to the borrowers because they're trying to raise the facilities. In the more complex deals, like the project finance deals and even the securitization or structured finance deals, we'll look at how we can allocate principles, we'll look at other loss allocation rules. It's essentially based on who is most able to identify and manage that risk. They should be responsible for the risk in the more complex deals. But in the simpler ones, we still need to understand this key issue of liability. What we can do is this. We'll look at this in terms of possible headings of liability, and we can identify five key headings of liability. We have common law misrepresentation. We have statutory misrepresentation and deceit. We have agency liability. We have fiduciary liability. And we have regulatory liability. So we're going to go through each of these so we can understand these. You need to be aware of all of this in practice because this is where difficulties, issues could arise, and you are responsible for your client's interest and to protect your client's position. We will then look at how we can control that liability. The three easiest ways to do it are through limited duty clauses, limited liability clauses, and then careful limitation of limiting liability. But we just have to watch that there are restrictions which may otherwise apply under the general law, which will restrict our ability to limit our client's liability. So we need to be aware of that and ensure that we comply with that as well. So we can understand this principally in terms of limited duty clauses, which are also called no basis clauses, limited liability clauses, and then the limitations on limiting liability. And then we'll look at remedies, and we can understand the remedies in terms of five key aspects as far as I'm concerned: suspension or withholding of any further advance, cancellation of obligation to lend, acceleration of repayment, rescission of the documentation, and then separate action for damages in contract or tort. The key point in relation to issue two here on limited duty, what we're going to do is this. We cannot be held liable for something that we were not responsible for. So what's the easiest way to limit your liability, scope of possible loss? Limit your duty. So you limit the duty to act, therefore, if you act outside that, you can't be held liable for that because you were only responsible for acting in a very small, narrow way. So the easiest way to limit your liability is to limit the scope of responsibility, to limit your duty. So this is called a limited duty or a no basis clause. And in the paper, I give a number of examples from principally the LMA master agreement. So no duty. I don't have a duty to do this. Information supply. You are responsible for collecting your own information, own credit assessment. You will undertake your own assessment of this information. You will form your own opinion. I am not responsible for any of that. You see what we're doing? We're limiting our duty carefully by stages, so that we don't create any scope for possible liability. You'll also have a non-reliance clause. You will specify that the other parties, mainly the other syndicate members, confirm we are not relying on you for any advice of any form, or any opinion in any way, or any direction or guidance line of any type. And then also no fiduciary duty. And what we'll see is this. in the LME, multi-currency standard term loan. It's expressly provided that there is no fiduciary duty owed by the agent bank or by the lead bank. And also, there's a specific clause in 26 which specifies that the lead bank, the arranging bank, will have no duties of any form whatsoever under the whole of this agreement. So essentially, what are the duties of the lead or arranging bank in law? Well, they're all the things we mentioned before. It's responsible for bringing the parties together, negotiating the documentation, bringing all of this forward, taking us up to the closing, setting up the facility, making everything in operation, after which the agent bank will then administer the facility. But under the loan documentation, what is the agent bank and lead bank responsible for legally? I'll give you a clue. Because there's a clause that says the lead bank shall have no responsibility or no duty of any form under this document in 26. So we can limit clauses through no duty clauses or basis clauses. Now, you can then limit liability. So under English law, we can have exclusion of liability clauses. I am not responsible for any loss of damage that may arise of any form. That's completely proper, completely enforceable. Photo Productions, Suited Lomtique, there's a whole series of case law that confirms all of this. However, we just have to watch how we draft it. The principle is that because we are restricting our potential liability, that's construed contra profferente. Because we drafted the clause, if it's ambiguous, if there's an ambiguity, it's interpreted against us in favour of the client who would otherwise be able to recover. We then have set-off. So we can have set-off clauses. We can then have estoppel, which is a form of procedural argument whereby because someone tries to sue you for something, you argue, well, you can't sue me for this because you've already agreed to this or agreed to something else, or because your conduct confirmed that you agreed that you'd already waived this. You see? So you can estoppel arguments as well. We can have set-off arguments. We can have estoppel arguments. We can have indemnity, even if our exclusion clause, our set-off and our estoppel arguments don't work, we can still get indemnity. So even if we're liable, we can still get an indemnity from another party. But again, there's restrictions on that we'll come back to. And then you've also got contributory negligence under the Law Reform Contributory Negligence Act 1945. And what that basically says is this: the court can look at the whole of the circumstances, and if, for example, it determines that both parties were equally at fault, although you can recover, you can only recover half your loss, because it was half your fault as well. And the court can decide 60-40, 75-35, any allocation it likes. So we can have contributory negligence. So there's lots of ways of limiting liability and recovering. We just have to understand how each of these may or may not apply in the particular case. Now, we then have limitations on limiting liability on the exclusion provisions. So construction. In all cases, the doctrine is that we will be interpreting these provisions contra profferente. It's understood, interpreted against the party drafting a restricted clause that protects it. So it will always be done in favour of the other party, in favour of the client in these cases. You cannot exclude liability for five key sets of things: fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation. Cannot use exclusion clauses in any of these cases. Criminal liability, statutory liability, which is where you have a separate statutory duty. The main issue in this case is what we call section 138D of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. There's a separate provision on statutory duty, 138D. What that specifies is that if someone suffers loss as a result of another party breaching any of the rules set up under the FSMA, Financial Services and Markets Act, they can be held liable for that. So it's breach of a separate duty created by another statute, which in financial aid, the main one is 138D of the FSMA, which specifies that if you breach a rule in the, for example, Financial Conduct Authority Handbook or the Prudential Regulation Authority Handbook, if you breach that, someone suffers loss, they can sue you for breach of statutory duty under section 138D. So that's statutory liability. You also can't exclude liability if the clause, the exclusion clause, was misrepresented, or if there was a separate oral warranty, which is another form of estoppel. So you've got a perfect exclusion clause, but then you have separately outside of that said something else after that clause came into effect. That wouldn't apply. We then also have statutory restrictions. The two key sets of provisions are the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977 imports a reasonableness test. There is also the Consumer Contracts Regulations 1999, although these were supplemented or superseded by further regulations, and all of this is now incorporated into the Consumer Rights Act 2015. So there were consumer right provisions which are now in the Consumer Rights Act 2015. However, these are not consumer transactions. These are large professional transactions between the biggest commercial banks, investment banks, governments and companies in the world. These are not consumers under any circumstances. So we can disapply these. We only need to look at the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which imports this reasonableness test, which is defined in Section 11.2 and Schedule 2, that applies specifically with regards to negligence under Section 6.1, as well as it's imported into the misrepresentation liability area under the Misrepresentation Act 1967 separately as well. So the main thing is we need to watch misrepresentation. And this is very easy in practice, because what you're essentially doing is this. You're drafting all of this documentation on the information provided by your client, and your client is going to exaggerate. Your client's not going to, I have to be careful how strong I put this, misrepresent something with intent, lie deliberately, but your clients will always exaggerate, and you need to watch this. It's your responsibility to pick up all of this and to correct all of this, because you're going to help them prepare the information memorandum, which will be done by the investment firm, the lead bank, and the client together, and the client's the accountant. The accountant is the internal financial advisor, the auditor is the external financial advisor. So the accountant, the company, and the lead bank together will prepare the information memorandum, which is also in the capital market area, the prospectus, or the listing particulars. You need to check them. That's your role and function. And if there's any terms, any points, anything that's stated which they haven't got proper evidence for, or if it looks exaggerated or unsubstantiated, you need to pull it up. And if necessary, you redline it. You need to ask for confirmation, or you just redline it, because that's where the liability is going to come. And it's either going to be innocent, negligent, or possibly fraudulent, or four statutory. There's four types of misrepresentation: innocent, negligent, fraudulent, and statutory. And this is what you're watching for, always. That nothing is said or stated in any of the documentation that you've prepared, that you were responsible for, that someone could be held liable for. This is your responsibility. And this can happen all the time. In practice, what will have happened is that the borrower's drawn down 100 million, or there was 100 million issuance, or something, and the borrower can't repay. So the question then is, who can sue who? And that's what this is all about. And usually it's lead bank it's syndicate members looking to see, can they sue other syndicate members, or can they usually go after the lead bank, the arranging bank, or the agent bank? That's what this is all about. But you have to protect it. You have to watch this more generally as well. Misrepresentation is very dangerous. You have to be sensitive to this all the time. Okay? So we've got our liability heads, we've got our limited duty provisions or basis clauses. We can limit liability. We can limit liability subject to the limitations on our ability to exclude and limit liability. And then we have our remedies, okay? This is what we're having to look at. All of this is discussed in further detail in this paper. Much of this began with a famous case called the Colcatronis Tanker Securities litigation in 1976. You'll see this in the footnotes. What had happened was a European American Banking Corporation, EABC, had set up a syndicate with a number of American regional banks to provide syndicated facilities to this shipping company, and there was a major default, and the question simply was, could the syndicate members recover against the lead arranging bank in that case? Now, this was at an early stage of development of the markets, and this took the markets completely by surprise. Everyone was shocked because of the liability, because no one had been considering this property before, properly before. What had happened was that the syndicate members argued that the European American Banking Corporation, it knew all of the relevant information, and it had a duty to advise. It hadn't provided and explained everything properly in terms of the risk to the other syndicate members. Syndicate members lost. Therefore, in that case, EABC was forced to settle. So that's it was a red marker. People had to pay attention to these issues for the first time. Well, not for the first time, but this really drew attention to this in the market. We had to be very careful about controlling the liability. And all of the provisions I was mentioning before about limiting duty, excluding liability, all of that becomes relevant after this. And that's why we have to be careful, because of this famous Recall Patronus Tanker Securities case back in 1976. I explain in this first subsection here about how we can proceed against different parties, although generally it's going to be very difficult to go against other syndicate members because they haven't really done anything. You're really principally looking at either the lead bank or the agent bank, because the agent bank has got a very limited administrative function only, and it doesn't get paid that much. It's not going to want to take on large possible heads of liability. So we specifically have to make sure that there's no liability unnecessarily created for the agent bank, but also to the extent responsible and reasonable, we're going to limit the liability of the lead bank. Very often you'll be acting for the lead bank. So this is what you're concerned about. In terms of the headings, we've got fraudulent misrepresentation, possibly negligent, and then innocent misrepresentation. Again, one of the key points that comes up simply is this, and this is what we were trying to consider when we looked at the difference between the conditions precedent, representations, which are statements of fact, and warranties, which are undertakings, and then the covenants. Well, we're looking at the nature of contractual provisions and the different shades and grades and nature of these, in particular with regards to the remedy. The main thing that the banks want is rescission. Why? Because if they can threaten rescission, they're in a very strong negotiating position. But a lot of things don't allow rescission. Innocent misrepresentation doesn't. Breach of a representation and possibly even breach of a warranty might not, depending upon how it's drafted. So that's why we're elevating those clauses. And in my chapter, on the loan chapter, there's a number of the footnotes that look at this and explain and discuss all of this, how we're trying to elevate provisions up to conditions, so that if it's a contractual condition and we breach it, the other party breaches it, the bank gets rescission. The banks don't want to rescind usually, because that will then trigger cross default and all the other facilities, but it puts the bank in a strong position. Being able to threaten that means the bank will get some form of renegotiated settlement. Now, on fraudulent misrepresentation, you will see here, there has to be falsity or recklessness, not caring whether something was true or false. So that's fraudulent misrepresentation, famous English case, Derry versus Peake in 1889. Rescission and damages are available. You then have negligent misrepresentation. Negligent misrepresentation is quite narrowly defined under English law. We need to establish some special relationship or connection of trust or confidence in some way. The famous case, the most famous decision, is Headley Byrne, which was a law case. This was a solicitor acting on behalf of clients. You also then have to establish inducement and causation in addition to this special relationship, so it's more difficult to establish, although there are examples of case law in that area, and I've provided those in the text. J.E.B. Fasteners, the Lucy, and Eddington. You've then also got innocent misrepresentation, although in that case we're not going to get rescission. So again, this is why we're going to always try to consider all available remedies, but as drafters, you have to be careful, even that you don't make an innocent misrepresentation, even though the consequences might not be as severe, you still have to be very careful indeed in practice. And again, I've provided case law on this. What then happened was this. Because of the difficulty in establishing fraudulent misrepresentation, you actually had to establish fraud in practice. This was very difficult to prove. So what they did was they created the Misrepresentation Act 1967. And under Section 2.1, we can be held liable for statutory misrepresentation without the need to establish fraud, provided that the other party cannot establish that he or she believed that the representation was true on reasonable grounds. What that essentially does is this. It reverses the burden of proof in the fraud cases. You don't have to establish fraud. You just establish the misrepresentation. It then shifts the burden of proof. The other party has to prove that they had reasonable belief that the statement was true. So this is the key provision most cases will be concerned with. Statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act, Section 2.1. You're effectively reversing this burden of proof. Now, we also have to consider agency liability and fiduciary duties. Essentially, what happens under the common law, there's a whole series of implied duties, principally to do with, you see here, you must act subject to contract, act with due skill, care and diligence, not delegate authority, and then also we're going to have additional provisions for a fiduciary, no conflicts of interest, no secret profit, and then again, exercise due diligence. So there's like 6-7 provisions there, and I've given examples of all of the case law in relation to each of these. We have to be careful with all of this. What you've essentially got is you've got additional levels of duty because it's a fiduciary, an agency relationship, and then again, if it's a fiduciary relationship, the standard of care arises even further, including, you'll see under this famous case, Boardman versus Phillips. Boardman versus Phipps, even though the trustee was acting in the client's interest to create a profit, that still constituted a secret profit and they were held liable. So full disgorgement but also breach of duty. Even though they were acting in the client's interest, that was still a secret profit. We have to be very careful about this. This comes up all the time in practice. Parties are always either acting for agents on behalf of each other, formally or by implication, but also in a large number of cases, courts can consider there's a fiduciary relationship implied here, a degree of additional duty of care which has to be respected. So you have to watch this, we have to be careful about this. In terms of regulatory liability, this principally for our purposes, because it's financial, we're concerned with the Financial Services and Markets Act. So we're looking at authorisation under the General Prohibition, which is section 19 of the FSMA. There's a specific permission requirement in section 20, and then there's restrictions on issuing promotions in section 21. Very clever. What we essentially do is this, we create a whole financial law based on three very simple clauses. You shall not carry on a regulated activity unless you are authorised or exempt. Section 19, general prohibition. Secondly, you must also have specific permission to carry on the particular activity, section 20, and then 21, you shall not issue a financial promotion unless it's fair, clear, fair and non-misleading, but specifically the section provides it must be issued by or authorised by an authorised person. It must be issued or approved by an authorised person, which essentially means they must import all these other requirements with regards to the content of that. These three very simple clauses have built one of the most complex, sophisticated financial regulatory laws in the world, the United Kingdom one. And it's all based on three very simple statutory provisions, section 19, section 20, and section 21. Now the key issue that arises in this case is simply that if you are entering into loan agreements, drafting loan agreements, entering into loan facilities in the euro dollar markets, is that a regulated activity? And the answer is, no, principally because banking is defined as essentially deposit taking in the UK or acting as a credit institution in the EU. And that's two things. It's accepting deposits from the general public and advancing credit or lending on own account. It's both the taking in of deposits, pooling them, and then lending. You have to do the two together. Now, strictly speaking, there is no definition of banking. In the United Kingdom, it's called deposit-taking business. In the European Union, it's called acting as a credit institution. But both of them are defined in the same terms. You have to both accept deposits and on lend. In the euro-dollar markets, does the money that's being on lend come from deposit business, from deposit basis, from retail or corporate deposits? No. Where does all the money come from? It just comes from the interbank markets. So because all of this comes from the interbank markets, this is not banking. So therefore, there's no need for regulation. Not until you go into the securities. But there is one qualification. There's an important case called the Fonds decision. In the Fonds decision, Mrs. Justice Gloucester and the other members of the appeal court, they had to consider this issue. In the particular facts of that case, the question arose was whether two loan agreements fell within a description of a debenture for the purposes of, I think it was for receivership or some form of recovery action proceedings. In that case, the court concluded that the loan agreement, including any undrawn amounts under the loan agreement, could constitute what's referred to as an instrument creating or acknowledging indebtedness under Article 77 of the Regulated Activities Order, RAO 2001, issued under the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. The general market opinion, before and after, has always been that a loan agreement by itself does not create or acknowledge indebtedness. The loan agreement only sets up the facility under which funds can be drawn down. The instrument creating or acknowledging indebtedness are the drawdowns under the loan agreement. For example, in the Loan Market Association Standard Multi-Currency Term Loan Agreement, Schedules 2 and 3 provide for utilisation. That's the drawdown. The utilisation request creates and acknowledges indebtedness. The loan agreement does not. What can actually happen is that a loan agreement will provide for the possibility to draw down multiple separate loans. For example, 10 borrowers, 10 banks under a $100 million facility, that can create up to 4,800 drawdowns minimum, even using a simple 2-year availability period. If you allow the revolving facility to operate for up to a full 20 years and to be drawn down almost every month, that takes it up to almost 10,000 separate loans. All of these loans under Section 2, 1, are all several and separate. They can all be enforced separately. They're all completely distinct. Although they're governed by a single loan agreement, there's actually between 4 and 5,000 up to 8, 9, 10,000 separate loans entered into under that single agreement between the different parties. If there's 10 banks and 10 borrowers, two facilities over a 20-year period. The market opinion always has been the loan agreement of itself does not create or acknowledge indebtedness, it's the drawdowns that do, because that's what creates the separate loans themselves. What actually happened was the City Law Group wrote to the Financial Conduct Authority about this in 2014. The issue came up. They realised the importance of this to the London markets. It was explained to the regulator that many of the major law firms were very concerned about this issue because it effectively reversed the understood market opinion. The FCA returned with a very short single paragraph statement saying, we do not consider that in the circumstances of the particular case that this has actually changed market practice or market application or the law in any material way. It's towards to that effect. What it was basically saying was this was can only should only be understood in terms of the circumstances of the particular case. We could go further and say basically this is wrong in terms of the larger finance loan and capital market that we're looking at. The loan agreement by itself does not create the indebtedness, it's the drawdowns. I've explained this and then the other issues. The information memorandum itself in a loan deal will not constitute a prospectus as such. However, when you then look at the prospectus and you're issuing securities, that could trigger regulatory provision although there may be exemptions that we can rely on, in particular, for example, with regards to rules like private placement. And I discuss all of this in the paper. There are some other issues with regards to financial promotion, although again, there's exemptions that allow us to promote things to small restricted professional groups. Is basically a parallel regime for private placement. When we're selling securities, we can also issue advertisements to the same types of people. And then you've also got the issue of market abuse. We have a civil liability provision for market abuse, market manipulation. It was created under section 118 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. The issue that had arisen was that authorities were very concerned that it was very difficult to pursue insider trading, insider dealing cases, because of the need to establish a criminal liability proof beyond reasonable doubt. Because that was very difficult to establish in many cases, they wanted to create a civil offence with a much lower balance of probability standard, so they created section 118 of the Financial Services and Markets Act, which was a very important provision. However, what's since happened is many of those measures have now been adopted into the Market Abuse Directive in the European Union, now the Market Abuse Regulation, and it's Regulation 596/2014. Because it's a regulation, it's directly applicable, therefore we've now disapplied, removed Section 118. We don't need Section 118 if we have the Market Abuse Regulation. Even with the UK withdrawal from the European Union, this has since been onboarded back into European law under the Withdrawal Acts 2017 and 2018. These are the key heads of liability. We simply have to be aware of these. We have to ensure that in any particular large finance case, finance transaction that we're involved with, we do not create any unnecessary possible source of concern and liability for our clients. In terms of controlling this liability, the simplest, most easiest way in practice is to have a no duty, what I call no duty, or a basis clause. A basis clause sets out the basis of the relationship. If you narrow that, you restrict that, you create a very restricted, narrow area of scope of duty and responsibility. Therefore, there's a very limited possible head of liability or heads of liability. I've given specific examples from the Loan Market Association documentation. We could have general no duty clauses, information supply clauses, own assessment clauses, non-reliance clauses, no inducement clauses, no fiduciary duty, and then a general no duty of any form owed by the lead bank under section 26 of the LME, Standard Multi-Currency and Term Loan Agreement. There are other ways that we can then exclude liability. We can have contractual exclusion. We can have clauses that simply exclude any possible loss and damage. These are perfectly legitimate and enforceable under English law. Hood versus Anchor Line, Cockerton, Swiss Atlantique, Photo Productions, George Mitchell, all of this. We can have these clauses. They're perfectly legitimate. We just have to ensure that we comply with any other relevant restrictions that we will come on to look at. There's also ways of limiting liability using set-off. Very often what will happen is under a loan agreement, we will deny the borrower's set-off against any of the banks, including the agent bank and the arranging bank, but we will preserve set-off by the banks against the borrower. That's in the, again, LMA standard documentation. We also have estoppel arguments. Estoppel is to do, it's a form of procedural defence. It's a procedural claim. It operates as a form of defence. Essentially, if someone tries to sue one of the banks for liability, the bank can say, well, you acted contrary to this in another way previously, which effectively either constitutes a form of admission of waiver or estoppel. There are some interesting recent estoppel cases in this area. I've explained them in the materials provided. Most of those simply support the principal financial decisions in this area. The lead cases include, for example, IFC versus Goldman Sachs, PK, JP Morgan versus Springwell. All of the references are in the paper. There was an interesting case, Barclays Bank versus Chivina Holdings, which confirmed this.
However, there was a slight qualification in the first Tower Trustees case. That was Legate J. Legate J had to consider, for the first time, the relationship between these arguments, this exclusion, and estoppel with the possible application of the reasonableness test under the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977. And what the court decided, and this was upheld by the appeal court, was that if you were using the estoppel arguments or the exclusion clauses to deny liability in a situation whereby the reasonableness test would otherwise apply in a misrepresentation action, that wasn't appropriate. So you can still have these clauses, but you can't use them to disapply another protection which would otherwise have been available. It's quite a small, fine point of law, but that was upheld by the Court of Appeal in this decision, First Tower Trustees. However, in later cases in the similar area, considering this from an equivalent perspective, all of the ERA decisions were fully supported. Premium Credit Limited versus Primary Care, Gold Life Foods and MotorTrack, and Interactive E-Solutions. All of that I placed in the separate note on the system. We can also have indemnity, so that even if we're held liable and our exclusion hasn't worked, we can still get an indemnity from the client to compensate us for the loss that we've already suffered and had to pay the client. And then contributory negligence. Under the Law Reform Contributory Negligence Act 1945, if the party suing is partly responsible, the court can limit the loss and allocate responsibility between them. So even if you've recovered, you can still be held 50% liable, which means you lose and only recover 50% of the damages that you could otherwise have been paid. So all of these are legal, legitimate ways for further limiting and controlling liability. We then have to consider the exclusion and the limitations on limiting liability. The key point is that all of this is construed contra profferentem, which is against the party drafting the clause. There are then a series of specific provisions that we cannot use exclusion clauses in relation to, where, for example, there is fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the effect of the misrepresentation clause, or the effect of the exclusion clause has been misrepresented itself, or there's been subsequent collateral warranty which is contrary to that. In all of these cases, you cannot rely on the exclusion clause. There are two statutory sets of provisions that we've mentioned already. There was the corporate protections provided under the Consumer Contracts Regulations. Those were then incorporated into a revised set of regulations, and it's now built into the wider protections made available under the Consumer Rights Act 2015. These only apply to consumers, and we'll actually see there's a definition of consumer in footnote 68. A person deals as a consumer where he neither makes the contract in the course of business nor holds himself out as doing so, and the other party makes the contract in the course of business. In the large, complex finance cases that we're looking at, there will not be any consumers involved, so we can disapply the consumer protection provisions. The key measure, then, is the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which imports this reasonableness test. What we're essentially doing is, in all cases where we apply the exclusion provision, we need to be able to justify that it's reasonable. Although in these particular cases, that's easier to establish simply because, again, as we've just mentioned, we're not dealing with consumers, we're dealing with professional counterparties, we're dealing with government and public bodies, we're dealing with some of the largest corporate entities in the world. We're always borrowing in these markets, and we're dealing with some of the largest law firms in the world. So the nature of reasonableness in these markets becomes a much more difficult test to try and disapply. It's much easier to satisfy any reasonableness consideration in these situations. So what we'll see is this. We apply the reasonableness test in standard clauses. That's under section 2. We cannot use this in relation to death or personal injury. That's section 2.1. In all other cases under section 2.2, where there's loss or damage, you have to satisfy the reasonableness test.
The reasonableness test is applied to any contractual provision that attempts to exclude or restrict liability or negligent misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. So the unreasonable contract terms Act 1977 specifically incorporates misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. Negligence is defined as being breach of any obligation arising under the express terms or implied terms of the contract to take reasonable care or exercise reasonable skill in the performance of the contract, or any common law duty to take reasonable care or exercise reasonable skill. The term must be fair and reasonable, having regard to the circumstances which were ought or reasonably ought to have been known to or in the contemplation of the parties. And then there's additional guidelines on the meaning of reasonableness in Schedule Section 11.1 and in Schedule 2. And that's expanded in the footnotes in the provision. It is therefore relevant. We have to be careful, although in practice, so long as our clauses are professionally and responsibly drafted, reflect general market practice, it is highly unlikely we would breach the reasonableness test in the types of situations that we are looking at. The effectiveness of the Unfair Contract Terms Act provisions in financial clauses, and then all of the other measures I've referred to before, were specifically considered in a series of recent decisions, including, for example, JP Morgan versus Springwell, as well as in the text you'll see IFE versus Goldman Sachs. You've also got the PK decision, you've got the Damala decision, and I've provided notes on each of these in the text, on the system. The Springwell case was very interesting indeed. This was before Mrs. Justice Gloucester and then the appeal court. This involved the sale of GKO linked notes, which were notes linked to Russian government bonds. So they weren't government bonds directly, it was linked notes, GKO linked notes. There was a default. The defendant, the action in this case was taken against JP Morgan Chase. It was by the Greek shipping family, Springwell, who had invested $500-700 million in this market, and they lost $500 million. So they tried to sue JP Morgan Chase for a breach of duty in relation to the losses that they suffered. What had happened was the Russian government, to everyone's surprise, defaulted on their bonds. Normally you'll default on your loan agreements, you don't default on your bonds, because therefore it affects your credit standing in future situations, future transactions. Russian government defaulted. This then triggered a non-payment clause in the GKO notes, so they were non-enforceable. Therefore, Springwell lost an enormous amount of money. Springwell tried to sue JP Morgan Chase for having sold them to the shipping family. This was an investment house, an investment company operation within this larger shipping group. A large number of arguments arose with regards to the scope of the duty of care by JP Morgan to Springwell, and then all of the possible heads of liability under contract, under TOR, and then all of the provisions I've mentioned already, these no basis clauses, which essentially are not exclusion clauses because they're just defining the scope of the relationship. All of the provisions, all of the protections we've been referring to were considered in this case, and all of them were upheld. And in almost all of the other cases we've mentioned, PK, Darmala, IFC versus Goldman Sachs, almost all of these cases, court will fully support the situation as we've explained them. The law as developed by finance lawyers acting on behalf of the major financial institutions in these markets, all of the standard documents, all of the standard clauses which have been developed, all of this is fully upheld, fully supported. What we'll see, there's a number of cases in which clients do suffer loss, which is very unfortunate, but still we have to apply the law properly and reasonably. The system, I'll give you notes specifically on IFE Fund SA versus Goldman Sachs International. In that case, the company lost 20 million euros. This was JSI, and it was held there was no liability, there was no misrepresentation, there was no negligence, there was no duty. What had happened was, I think Goldman Sachs had obtained further information
further reports and hadn't disclosed those, hadn't revealed those, although it was determined there was no duty to do so. And because of the scope of the liability provisions and the protections, there was no liability in that case. In PK versus Intermark, I think that was the one that also involved the GKO notes. So you read PK with Springwell. And again, a substantial amount was lost. There was arguments that there was duty of care, and the judge dismissed all of this. What had specifically happened was the salesperson in that case had described one set of transactions, although they then sent over documentation with the protection set out in what were called the final terms and conditions, the FTCs, which applied to a completely different type of transaction, which the client then entered into in writing. And what the court said was the party had essentially been induced by his own error, his own misrepresentation, by not checking the documentation before he entered into and signed all of the documentation concerned. Similar approaches adopted in Bankers Trust versus Dharmala. There was one interesting case, which was the Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank versus Morgan Stanley. That actually involved the purchase of a lot of the structured finance products which were common during the global financial crisis. The issue that arose was an investor entitled to rely on the ratings produced by credit rating agencies during the global financial crisis? In that particular case, it was Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley had argued that it was unreasonable for the client to do so, and that the client had an own independent separate duty of care to consider this outside the issue with regards to the validity of the credit, these credit rating agencies. My own opinion, again, in that case, is that's completely wrong. The court actually held that, in dismissing Morgan Stanley's argument, the court agreed that the investors were sophisticated, but it concluded that the market had come to rely on the accuracy of credit ratings and the independence of credit rating agencies, and therefore this reliance was reasonable. I personally think that's wholly inappropriate. What had actually caused the global financial crisis to a very significant extent was the fact that many parties in the markets had, to a large extent, only and simply relied on the figures produced by credit rating agencies. These were mispriced. They had overrated the price of these structured finance products, principally collateralized debt obligations. Most of the investors in the market that were buying those simply relied on the excess, mispriced, uncorrelated credit rating figures, credit rating levels, AAA, BBB, whatever, without actually taking any independent judgment. That's actually what caused the global financial crisis, because there was a massive over-reliance on these ratings. These ratings were overpriced, and then the ratings started to downgrade. Once you started to downgrade those, you created this default spiral. And through a combination of ratings downgrades, margin calls, forced asset disposals, mark-to-market accounting, and then further rating downgrades, that's what caused the global financial crisis. To see, as this judge has concluded, that it was reasonable, because everybody else in the market was making the same mistake as you, that it was reasonable to do that, I think is wholly inappropriate. So that, again, this is another example of courts taking decisions when they don't have full information and possibly full advice on the nature of the markets and the causes of the underlying facts and circumstances involved in these particular decisions. But generally, we will see that in all of the principal cases we're looking at, IFE, Funds, Goldman Sachs, PK, Dharmala, and virtually all of these cases, Springwell as well, all of the protections that we've already described in this paper are fully upheld and given effect to. This creates a proper, reasonable, proportionate, and fully enforceable level of protections for all clients and all parties in these markets going forward.